Welcome to Beekeeping Today Podcast, presented by Bee Culture. Beekeeping Today Podcast is your source for beekeeping news, information, and entertainment. I'm Jeff Ott.
And I'm Kim Flatham.
Hey, Jeff and Kim. Today's sponsor is Global Patties. They're a family-operated business that manufactures protein supplement patties for honeybees. It's a good time to think about honeybee nutrition. Feeding your hive's protein supplement patties will ensure that they produce strong and healthy colonies by increasing brood production and overall honey flow. Now is a great time to consider what type of patty is right for your area and your honeybees. Global offers a variety of standard patties as well as custom patties to meet your needs. No matter where you are, Global is ready to serve you out of their manufacturing plants in Airdrie, Alberta, and in Butte, Montana, or from distribution depots across the continent. Visit them today at www.globalpatties.com.
Thanks, Sherry, and thank you, Global Patties. You know, each week we get to talk about how much we appreciate our sponsor support, and we know you'd rather we get right to talking about beekeeping. However, our great sponsors are critical to help making all of this happen. From the transcripts, the hosting fees, the software, the hardware, the microphones, the subscriptions, the recorders, they enable each episode. So with that, thanks to Bee Culture Magazine for continuing their presenting sponsorship of this podcast. Bee Culture has been the magazine for American beekeeping since 1873. Subscribe to Bee Culture today. Hey everybody, thanks for joining us. We're really happy you're here. Before we get started, just a quick reminder to subscribe or follow Beekeeping Today podcast and give us a 5-star rating. It really does help. Also, we are now adding complete transcripts of each episode on the website after the show notes. Check them out. You can also leave questions and comments online under each show. You can leave a comment, ask a question, reply to a question, ours or our listeners. Click on leave a comment at the top of the episode's show notes to join the discussion. Have you listened to an episode and thought, that person sounds really interesting, and I'd like to know more about them? Well, now you can. Each episode links to a guest profile. Each profile has a guest photo, bio, contact information, including Instagram and Twitter details if they have them. Check it out. And finally, share the podcast with your beekeeping friends, email them links, or mention it at your next beekeeper meeting. Hey, everybody, thanks for listening. I hope your spring is going well, no matter where you are. Kim is joining us in just a few. We have a big episode set for you today. Later on, we have Dr. Frank Rickovich and Dr. Michael Simone talking about their work on the USDA ARS line of Poline honeybees. It's bred with the Varroa Sensitivity Hygiene, or VSH, as well as and testing its viability as a honeybee for commercial beekeeping. It's a fascinating discussion you will want to hear. Recently, I met up with Dr. Dude Karen at a local beekeeper meeting and was able to talk to him briefly about his Pacific Northwest honeybee survey. We'll hear about that in just a few minutes. But first, Kim is joining us with a review of Beekeeping at Buckfast Abbey, an old book by Brother Adam. Let's get to that right now.
Hi, this is Kim Flatham again with another session of Bee Books Old and New, kindly sponsored by Northern Bee Books, publishers of hundreds of books on bees and beekeeping, plus they have available a huge collection of used and antiquarian beekeeping books. Check them out at www.northernbeebooks.co.uk. You've probably heard of Brother Adam, a monk who lived in Buckfast Abbey in the very south-central section of the UK, located very close to the southern coast of the island, and heading west towards Land's End. He was introduced to bees and beekeeping when he took residence at the Abbey and was taught much of the craft by the Abbey's resident beekeeper, Brother Columban, who had been in charge of the bees since 1895. In 1915, Brother Adam was appointed to assist Brother Columban. As it turns out, the timing was either terrible or extremely fortunate, depending on your perspective. The Isle of Wight disease was at its height throughout all of England, and all predictions in the fall of that year were that there would be no bees left in the country come spring. For background, the disease had been discovered, though the cause was not yet identified, on the Isle of Wight, a small island just off the coast of south central England, very close to the Abbey. It spread to much of the UK fairly rapidly because of unrestricted bee movement and was rapidly causing the collapse of beekeeping in the country. It was this event in the UK that led the USDA to forbid the import of any honeybee from anywhere in the world to avoid unknown diseases and pests from coming here. It worked for a while, I guess. But the winter of 1915-16, though difficult, did not see the end of beekeeping. at least at the Abbey, as 16 of the Abbey's 46 colonies survived. However, those that perished were all native Blackbees. Not native in the sense they were originated in the UK, but were the dominant strain in the use there for many years. While those that did not perish were all of fairly recently imported Italian origin. This fact was not lost by the resident beekeeper. That summer, using the Italian stock, they made good their losses, and the next year increased numbers to 100 colonies. Finally, in 1919, Brother Columban retired, and Brother Adam was put in charge of the Abbey's bees. It must be noted that the focus of this book is not nearly so much about the whys of the management techniques described, but simply the whens and the hows of their management. The reason the Abbey had bees was to achieve maximum yields of honey per colony, entailing a minimum of effort and time. As Brother Adam states in the preface, when all is said and done, success in beekeeping is, in its final analysis, determined by our ability to ensure that every colony is at all times in the best condition to make the most of a honey flow when one comes along. This book has three sections. Part one deals with general observations, looking at the bees used by Brother Adam, the hive and the apiary, and the reasons for keeping bees. He sums this up nicely. He needed a bee that was able to withstand the demands of modern beekeeping, a hive of sufficient size to allow a colony to gather as much honey as possible, and a beekeeper smart enough to keep out of the way of his bees. Section 2 is simply seasonal management, in great detail, but simply what he did in each season and what tools and equipment he used to accomplish what needed done. If you are rather new at bees, these sections are fundamental, and you will gain insight into good seasonal management. However, the last section is on breeding, the skills Brother Adam is best known for. He carefully explains the need of isolation of breeding colonies, the production of drones needed to ensure nearly pure crosses, and much of the rest of what is needed to raise good queens with desirable traits. But it is his enumeration and detail of these traits that should be noted here especially. These include fecundity, or how many eggs can a queen lay. Industry is simply how much of what kind of work will workers do. Disease resistant absolutely must be on this list, but care must be taken so resistance to the appropriate diseases are chosen. A disinclination to swarm is indispensable, along with longevity, which both the bee and the beekeeper play a hand. Wing power means how far will workers fly for food, coupled with a keen sense of smell. Defense is important, but our experience here with African bees may have some role here. Winter hardiness for those of us with winter is important, but no less important is spring buildup. Some colonies are thrifty, that is, resource conservative, while some are not, which also covers self-provisioning, or how much will they store for winter. Comb building, both speed and skill, is critical, as is pollen collection. Less important to Brother Adam, but important enough for him to mention, were having a good temper, meaning calm on the combs, little propolis collection, and little brace comb construction. But attractive cappings, white better than wet, are needed, and a keen sense of orientation is needed for those foragers who travel further than most. All of these traits, we'll note, are good for the beekeeper first, and perhaps good for the bee in the long run, and that's only a perhaps. The value of this book lies not so much in what strains of bees to use to accomplish this art, but importing bees is essentially impossible, but rather gaining the full understanding of what traits are needed by beekeepers to develop a strain of bee needed where you are. One other thing Brother Adam mentioned was to never forget that the bee is in charge of this, not the beekeeper. We far too often forget that important point, but one wonders if that is completely correct. This book is published and available from Northern Bee Books and is available on Amazon. That's it for today, folks. We'll talk to you next time.
All right. This is Jeff. I'm in the Olympia Beekeepers Association meeting. And who do I run in today? It's Dr. Dewey Caron. Dewey, I'm glad to see you, actually, and not on Zoom.
Thank you, Jeff. This is, I think, the first live meeting of this group. That's exciting. I like that.
It's the first time in a long time, but it's good to actually see people around. So what brings you up to Olympia?
So I was doing a bunch of talks coming north, so I had arranged to have one trip to get meetings in several different of the club groups. This group lost their meeting, so I ended up having to come back to just to do this meeting tonight. So I'm up and down, up and back, and a real quick trip.
That's really generous of you, especially considering the price of fuel in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, indeed. And the fact that we're in one of our still our wet, rainy seasons, have to travel in the rain.
Absolutely. Hey, you know, and it's great. I really enjoyed talking with you because I'm always whining, as our listeners know, about the Pacific Northwest honeybee keeping and how difficult it is for me to get used to from coming from Ohio and Colorado. And tonight's, you talked about your Pacific Northwest bee survey that you've been doing, and you compare the management practices of so many beekeepers in the area. That's really fascinating. How long have you been doing that?
So I had started doing survey work in the East, as we have mites. One of the issues is what are people doing? It's a way for surveys are one way to look over your beekeeper's neighboring fence. So when I moved from the University of Delaware with retirement to live in a Portland area, I started doing a survey here. So I'm now in my 13th year of this survey. I'm looking at both the backyarder beekeeper, so individuals that have fewer or 50 or fewer colonies, as well as in a different survey at the larger scale, the commercial beekeepers. And so what then I do with the information is not only what level of loss are we experiencing by our types of hives, by our hive origination, whether it's an overwintered colony or a new colony we started, but I'm also looking at some key managements. And if you do some sort of a management, you feed them, let's say, a dry sugar, mm-hmm. What kind of level of survival do you have? So I compare the individuals that do feed, let's say, a dry sugar. I split it by fondant or dry vert or sugar candy and their level of loss. And then I'm comparing it to the overall level of loss. So it's a pretty conservative look at in terms of, can some of these managements make a difference in overwintering? And indeed, we find that a number of them do make a difference. And it's not necessarily just what's going to work this year. So now I have a good database. So I'm actually looking at the past several years. So I'll say that, using a sugar candy over winter, in the last 7 of 8 winters, that made a difference in individuals doing that management having a better survival. In other words, a lower loss rate.
Well, that's really fascinating. And this is all available on your website. What's that website?
So this is available on pnwhoneybeesurvey.com. You can take the survey there or then look at these past results. For clubs such as the club here that have a return of roughly 20 or more surveys, I generate an individual club report. So it's immediately looking over the beekeeping fence of your immediate neighbors here in this club, plus those in Pierce County and in Lewis County, the immediate counties close by here, as well as your other Washington beekeepers that are included in the survey, and Oregon survey backyarders as well.
Well, that's really cool, and it's great to have that as a beekeeper. It's great to have that information readily available. It helps me manage my bees to see what other beekeepers in the area are doing that works in this location. As they say, beekeeping is all local, so that's really great
work. It is local, and it is timing. And you might know one or two other beekeepers, but this is giving you a look at another 20 people in your immediate area that are doing this or not doing this and what kind of level of success they had.
And what else are you working on?
I am the overall representative for the whole region for the organization called WAS, Western Apiculture Society. We have not yet gone back to our live annual meeting, so we are having monthly meetings of a mini conference. We're featuring two speakers, sometimes on the same topic or related, sometimes not. So this month, myself and a beekeeper who has an interesting project in British Columbia are looking at bees in cities and urban areas. It's come on very strongly, and there are companies that are selling corporations the idea of saving the bee, doing something of benefit for the environment, educating their own employees about pollination and the importance of working and to help save bees by having colonies of bees be on rooftops of their city buildings or their campuses where they're doing their research or their development work or their headquarters. Well, what is happening is we're finding that we're getting an awful lot of bees in urban area. And so we'd like to get a dialogue going in terms of how what are the necessary supports that need to be in place where we're moving from bees in an agricultural area to having as many located in urban areas.
Wow, that's really good work. And you've been doing that for this year? You started this year, or have you been doing it for a couple of years?
So I've been doing some of the tracking for a couple of years. We have some of our associations that have more members in a city. We also ask the location, so we're actually doing some mapping, and so we're separating out from our database with the PNW Honeybee Survey, those that are in urban settings versus those that are in more rural areas, and those in urban settings are not doing as well as those in more urban settings as a general rule. There, of course, are some exceptions, but it does appear like we are overloading the carrying capacity for the cities and resources that are available for the bees by bringing in so many bee colonies, whether it's for corporations or individuals that are just, you know, what I talked about tonight was colony creep, where you start with a couple of colonies, but all of a sudden with divides and capturing swarms, you end up with really more colonies. Your numbers of colonies have creeped upward, more colonies than you care to take care of or really wanted to ever do.
More of a challenge, especially on rooftops.
And especially on rooftops, yeah. Present a whole new challenge for getting your equipment there, getting the honey back down off that roof, et cetera. Yes.
Yeah, there's entertaining stories about beehives and elevators and the looks people get. So, Dewey, I know you need to get back down the road, I-5, and it's getting dark, so I'll let you go. I look forward to having you back on the podcast here soon and talk with Kim as well.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm a faithful listener for the podcast. You always have some of the very, very good guests, very interesting guests on. It's always an interesting topic, so it's time well worth spent. And appreciate the effort that you and Kim are doing to put out those regular podcasts. Thank you.
Well, I really appreciate those kind words, and I do agree. We have great guests, and it's especially fun when I get to see them face-to-face like I am now. Thanks so much, and have a great trip home.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Hey, beekeepers! Many times during the year, honeybees encounter scarcity of floral sources. As good beekeepers, we feed our bees artificial diets of protein and carbohydrates to keep them going during those stressful times. What is missing, though, are key components. The good microbes necessary for a bee to digest the food and convert it into metabolic energy. Only Super DFM Honeybee by Strong Microbials can provide the necessary microbes to optimally convert the artificial diet into energy necessary for improving longevity, reproduction, immunity, and much more. Super DFM Honeybee is an all-natural probiotic supplement for your honeybees. Find it at strongmicrobials.com or at fine bee supply stores everywhere.
Thanks a lot, Strong Microbials. And right back to the show, sitting across the virtual Zoom table right now are Dr. Frank Rinkovic.
Rinkovic.
Sorry. Oh, boy. I knew I was going to. We practiced this before we started recording, and I still messed it up. Sorry, folks. And Dr. Mike Simone Finstrom. Did I get that right? So yep. I know NPR will never hire me now. Welcome, guys, to Beekeeping Today podcast.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Frank and Mike, this is the first time I've had the opportunity to meet you in person, such as it is. I know about your work. You are both scientists at the USDA Bee Lab in Baton Rouge, mm-hmm. and you have been working on something called the pole bee. Or the pole line of bees, and I have not heard that phrase before this. Maybe it's because I wasn't paying attention, or you went up and changed the name on me, but tell us what your pole line of bees is, a little bit of the history, certainly, so people know where it came from, and then your recent research and some of the results, and I'm probably going to interrupt you and ask some questions during all of this. So I don't know who wants to start.
The pauline bee is one that you might not have heard before, because the more common iteration or version of it had been VSH. So these are mostly VSH, which means Varroa sensitive hygiene. So these are bees that have been bred for the specific trait where they remove Varroa parasitized brood. And this is a selection that's been going on at the Baton Rouge lab well before either Frank and I started at the lab. So there's a strong history of that breeding program at the lab. And then the iteration that got it to Pauline was led by Bob Danka, who's now retired, but involved with this project that we're talking about. And what they did as part of that effort is they bred or outcrossed these VSH bees into several different commercial operations to make sure that the bees that are expressing this VSH, this Varroa resistance trait, at a high level, that they can also be productive colonies in commercial operations. And so the pollen line is really bees that are well suited for pollination services. So that's sort of where that name came from. And then after that happened, and there was one large paper of the production of those Pauline bees, we brought them back to the USDA lab in Baton Rouge and really further refine that breeding. And so then this recent study that came out is really the first big test of that really well-developed line expressing both this Varroa-sensitive hygiene trait at a really high level and consistent level, along with these other productivity traits that beekeepers are interested in. And really, that's what the industry needs.
So does it make honey and stay alive, basically, is what it comes down to, it sounds like. Your study, you brought in commercial beekeepers and a significant number of colonies. I don't see the numbers, but if you're working with commercial beekeepers, I bet you it isn't two out in the backyard. How many were involved in these experiments? About?
I think we started with close to 400. Is that about correct, Mike?
Yeah, between the 2 years, it was at least 150 per year, or a little bit upwards of that, So this is a large scale, but in terms of the commercial beekeepers, it's still a small number. But we were really going with these sample sizes that were going to be relevant to the beekeeping industry. So we filled up 4 different apiaries in this commercial operation, and then they traveled through the circuit to really give them a real test of what's happening in the real world. We partner as much as we can with commercial beekeepers in particular, because if what we're doing doesn't work for them, we're not doing, fully what we need to do for the industry.
Well, that also I wasn't aware of. It says that you overwintered these bees in Mississippi, California, North and South Dakota, certainly large honey producing states. But what I also wasn't aware of is that these were actual real world working bees. You put them on trucks and you pollinated them and you split them and all the things that commercial beekeepers do. And you started them in the spring, went the whole season.
Yeah. So basically we made splits with the beekeepers. So we use the splits from the beekeepers so that everything was being done exactly as they would do. We naturally made it our queens in an area with our drone. So again, similar to what the beekeepers do with and what the beekeeper we worked with, he mated his queens in his standard way. We mated them naturally in a drone saturation area so that they were mating with our Pauline drones. Then we put all the splits in the same spot. He loaded them up and their team loaded them up on the truck and brought them to the Dakotas and then disperse them in the apiaries until October. And then in October, they moved to California to the holding yards. There was a subset that just went back to Mississippi and stayed there as kind of a control for once it didn't go to California. Then they pollinated almonds after making honey all summer. And then they made it back to Mississippi to be, you know, splits for the new year.
Well, real world beekeeping. And the results then are going to reflect what a commercial beekeeper could probably expect doing whatever it is he does during the course of a year. So that would add, from my perspective, I do have a lot more confidence in the results of this study because you made them work.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's good.
As I say, as a scientist, because we like to be in control and have every factor accounted for. But in commercial beekeeping, sometimes things are out of your control and you have to just roll with it. And that's why we use these big sample sizes. As we all know, beekeeping can be unpredictable at times. So a lot of colonies make it into the study and then just keep track of them. That's kind of a challenge. And it takes us a lot of places. So working with people, like I said, in the Dakotas where honey is being made, in California where almonds are being pollinated. So yeah, the relevance is very high to the commercial beekeeping industry for sure.
I bet you guys spend a lot of time biting your tongues, right? Saying, don't do it that way because, and they went ahead and did it that way anyway, because that's what they do.
I mean, yes and no. I mean, really this test was, do these bees work with what, you know, with what beekeepers are doing, right? And so we want them to treat them, you know, as they're going to, you know, to a degree. Obviously, it's like, and the beekeepers that we work with are really great about, you know, understanding that balance of, well, this is science, and so we need some more data. So unfortunately for them, they have to leave colonies that they would normally combine, you know, in the holding yards in California. They would combine them before almonds or even after almonds, but so they're not combining them. And so then they have somewhat weaker stuff. You know, some of the stragglers might still be persistent when they would have removed them, right? So they work with us and we work with them, and we know that we're confident in the data that we're getting back is really applicable to what's going on.
I want to go jump back to the beginning real quick because I'm just intrigued by the name, the Pauline. And Michael, you had mentioned something that they were originally developed specific or with pollination directly in mind, or was it, you know, pollination first, honey second? Was there a preference in the selection?
So unfortunately, we weren't part of the naming process, right? So okay. I think some of the naming process came, and I believe it was even one of the suggestions of one of the beekeepers that was working with this line when they were sort of developing with the combining the bees from here with their bees. And one of the suggestions was to make the name. So it's not necessarily pollination but it's the idea that they will work for pollination services, right? So that pollination services is what's driving the industry, not necessarily honey production, right? So they need to produce honey and they need to be effective for pollination services, whether that's going up and down the East Coast or to California and almonds. So that's where that name came from, that it's for pollination services. And really that means that they're going to be big in early spring and be productive, strong bees. And that's ultimately what that name means.
It would have been confusing to call them worker bees because that, right. That name's taken. Well, that's really fascinating. So Kim had asked earlier, and maybe I missed the answer. What was the original stock for these? You selected for the VSH, but were they more the Carniolan, or were they more Italian, more?
Yeah, so the Pauline, the original VSH population was largely derived from Italian bees. So so that's sort of the base population. And then, you know, certainly there's some mixture in there, but the Pauline then had been bred mostly just with insemination, so within the population. So then it kind of closed the population again, especially after they were in the commercial operations and then brought back. But it's largely an Italian-based stock. You know, however, it's that's one of the things that I think is important to express about these Pauline bees, and really when we're talking about these mite-resistant traits, is that, you know, there's Varroa-sensitive hygiene is expressed in Carniolan bees, Italian bees, Russian bees, and that's something that that a number of beekeepers and queen breeders, you know, are selecting for these sort of Varroa-resistant traits. And so it really doesn't matter if they're Italian or not from that perspective.
Okay, well, let's take this opportunity to hear from our great friends at Better Bee.
Hey, podcast listeners. If you've got a couple years of beekeeping under your belt and you're looking for a new challenge, available from Better Bee is the Hog Half Comb System, a mess-free comb honey system that you put on a strong hive for your bees to fill. Made of 32 to 40 individual food-grade recyclable cassettes, it only takes popping off the covers and sticking on your labels to get your half combs ready for sale. Visit betterbee.com/HOGG today to learn more and start making your own mess-free comb honey.
Part of this experiment was to treat some of these bees and to not treat some of these bees. And you had some spectacular results, I think. The bees that you treated, what was the treatment?
So the treatment went on in the fall after honey gets pulled off. They really need to treat for Varroa, because up till that time when those boxes of honey come off, that's the longest time the Varroa has been able to develop within the absence of a miticide treatment. So the beekeeper that we work with, they're treating right after that event occurs. And this treatment goes on, and that's usually what they do for the fall treatment. And then in the wintertime, they'll do another treatment as well. And so in that process with our experiment, we had it designed to set up to see, does Pauline need that fall treatment in order to have very low Varroa? So in some of the colonies, we skipped that fall treatment. And when I say fall, I mean late August, when they pull honey. Some of them got that treatment and some of them didn't get the treatment. But then they all got treated in the wintertime when they went to either California or Mississippi for holding. So we have a high treatment and a low treatment. The high ones got both the fall and winter, and the low treatment only got the winter treatment. And in that case, the commercial stock that got the low treatment, only the skip the fall, only winter, they had really poor performance. I think that the final total was under 10% survival, if I got that correct, Mike.
Yeah, it was between... 10 and 20% survival for sure.
But when Pauline only had the low treatment, they skipped that fall treatment, survivorship was over 50%. So a very big difference in the commercial versus Pauline treatments. But when both stocks got the high treatments, fall and winter, they performed kind of similarly. Pauline had a little bit higher survivorship, but the commercial really needed that fall treatment in order to have high survivorship around 50%. So it just shows that Pauline can perform pretty well without that fall treatment. The fall treatment definitely helps, but it doesn't have that dramatic effect like it does in unselected stocks. And that was kind of what we almost kind of expected that, because when we work with these bees at the lab, we know that they could maintain very low Varroa levels without any kind of miticide treatment. So to see that without any miticides in the field, they still performed quite admirably. That was very good to get that data for sure.
The treatment, whether either one or two treatments, the product applied to these bees was the choice of the commercial beekeeper, or you did that? So were all of the treatments using the same product, or were there different products being used?
Yeah, so it was all the same product, all the colonies. A lot of commercial beekeepers like to treat all their colonies the same. So that was actually really good for part of the experimental design, but that they all got treated the same in terms of miticide application. So yeah, same product, same timing, all that stuff was kind of very consistent across the treatments.
Would you recommend this product to other beekeepers to use? And can I ask you the name just so folks have an idea?
So amateurized-based products are what most beekeepers are using. And so we actually study amateurized resistance in Varroa, because a lot of beekeepers that rely on amateurized as the miticide of choice, if you only are using that to control Varroa, it tends to lead to higher treatment rates. And because if a little bit works, maybe a little bit works even better. And so what we've been finding out is that these Varroa are being selected for resistance. And that's a whole other aspect of my research that we're working on. So what's really interesting about this VSH behavior and these pollinating bees is that we could hopefully reduce some of our reliance on these miticides to really mitigate the development of resistance. If we could get away with that one less fall treatment, perhaps, it's really good for delaying the onset of the potential of resistance. The other thing is that if you maybe miss a treatment or you forget to treat an apiary in a certain bit of time, this VSH behavior kind of acts as a little bit of redundancy in your Varroa treatment program. So I think that going forward, that there should be I think that it also helps to build a more robust, resilient Varroa management program by incorporating these bees with VSH behavior, for sure.
Well, the like I said before, the states that the bees that you were working with were from Mississippi, California, North and South Dakota. Did you see a location difference? I mean, I know winters in Mississippi are significantly different than winters in North Dakota. And I'll just throw a tail end on there. Were any of these beekeepers wintering their bees inside? So location, I guess.
Sure. So one of the things that we did look at in terms of the Mississippi perspective. So all of the bees went to the Dakotas, and that was really just for honey production. Then a large portion of them went to California, and so then they stayed there for the winter. So they didn't, when it started snowing, they get out of the Dakotas, right? And then they go and sit in California. The other subset went to Mississippi. Those stationary ones, or we had another set that really just stayed in Mississippi, and that was the biggest location difference. And that was because, in all honesty, there wasn't the management that they were getting in the Dakotas, and so they ran out of food because there wasn't great food for them in the summer in Mississippi, which is one of the reasons why they leave, right? And so the biggest location difference was that when you're not properly managing colonies, they can starve because they don't have enough resources in certain places. And, you know, particularly in the South, and when I was in North Carolina, we often had to feed colonies in August too, because if they're not getting the resources because it's not a good location. And that's one reason why we have to move bees around, right? So we don't really have, I wouldn't say, great sort of locational evidence in terms of overwintering from this particular experience. But we have worked, you know, and collaborated with others that are working with these pollinating bees around the country. And they overwinter just as well in the Midwest as they do here in Louisiana, which is really nice to see.
Well, it's even more real world in this experiment. And were any of these people wintering indoors?
Oh, sorry. No, we didn't do. So this was all done with one commercial beekeeper in this particular case, and so we haven't done any indoor overwintering here.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm just curious about that.
Well, that's actually interesting you bring that up, because I'm working on this grant with a bunch of other people from across the country to do this sort of holistic Varroa control program. And so one of them is to use different stocks of bees in these overwintering facilities, like you're mentioning, to see if there's any sort of stock interactions with this overwintering, because there's this idea that some bees are adapted to their local environment and selective how they're brought up. And so we want to check to make sure that these pollinating bees, or the one that we run here, can survive in these cold overwinter climates, just because, you know, Louisiana doesn't get too cold here even in the winter, but we want to see how they perform in those cold overwintered sort of environments, because I know that a lot of people are interested in the benefits that an overwinter indoor storage can't have on their bees. So we want to make sure that these bees are performing well under all conditions. So the more that we could study it, the more that we could see if they're applicable across the board.
The other half of the varroa problem, of course, are the viruses. And I know you looked at, I want to say, the three major viruses that you were looking at. And did you see, I guess the question would be between treated and non-treated, and then treated once and not treated. Did you see three piles of dead bees or not? Three different sized piles of dead bees from virus from this?
Yeah, sure. Most of the virus difference that we see is really between sort of unselected stock or the mite-resistant stock. We see that you tend to have less viruses in pollinating bees. And in large part, you know, the viruses do correspond to mite levels, right? So when you have less mites reproducing and feeding on offspring, that generally tends to reduce the viruses overall in the whole population, particularly with deformed wing virus. And in this case, chronic bee paralysis virus 2, which has sort of a mild association with varroa. Interestingly, we didn't find a difference in the amount of black queen cell virus between the two populations. And that's one that's not transmitted by varroa. So there's something else going on there. But we definitely see pretty clear differences in deformed wing virus, which we've seen now several times with sort of VSH bees, but a lot with the Russian bees too. They tend to carry less deformed wing virus. And we think that's also in part because of keeping the varroa in check. So there's definitely a good thing. If you're keeping the mites in check, you're keeping the viruses in check too.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Which one of you was the lucky person who got to do all those virus samples?
Well, yeah, thankfully. So all that virus work gets done in my lab, but Thomas O'Shea Weller, who is the postdoc who led all these analyses, he had the wonderful task of mashing up bunches of bees and doing all of the extractions and viral analysis.
Well, one of the things I was interested in knowing is how sticky is the pollen in a given group. How often would a beekeeper need to re-queen his operation to maintain that breed line?
So the genetics of VSH in pollen is quite tricky because this is a complicated behavior where they have to first detect these infested cells, then uncap it, remove it. So it's a stereotypical behaviors that they have to be coordinated. So there's probably a lot of genes involved. Exactly how many, we're not too sure, but we have some ideas. But what's interesting is that since it's such a polygenic trait covered by many different genes, it seems like after you cross one of these highly selected queens with a non-selected drone, the offspring tend to have some sort of level of VSH behavior. But when those daughters then reproduce to make their granddaughters, they tend to have very low levels of expression. So after about two rounds of outcrossing to non-VSH drones, they tend to dilute the behavior. And that's what's really tricky is to maintain this in a population, we have to create this kind of genetic momentum. So that way when they are mating, they are outcrossed and mating to open drones, that those drones are also VSH, so they can maintain it. And that's what's really tricky is we have to find out what level of penetrance in the population we have to get these genes, so that way it kind of maintains itself without constant infusion of this genetic material.
Yeah, whether that those traits, well, since it's multiple genes expressing it, right? So that wouldn't be multiple recessive traits, I guess.
And the good thing is, though, we demonstrate that we can do this because initially with this pollen line, it was maintained by instrumental insemination, so very highly controlled breeding. But the ones that we did for this experiment, we just let them open mate in drone aggregation areas. Like Mike said, we saturate it with pollen line drones. So if a breeder is working with this, they can maintain this phenotype with open mating, which is actually a really big important step to making this commercially viable. Because I don't know too many queen producers who are going to instrumentally inseminate every queen. It's just, it's a lot easier to open mate them for sure.
Yeah, I think to me, that was one of the most exciting things about these results, because this was really that first this was the first time that we had really naturally mated pollen in this kind of drone saturation area. So that's a big step in towards moving this breed or stock forward, I think. But the other thing is, we really need to continue to work on tools for selection that beekeepers can use for these traits. And there's, groups, kind of led by Kara Wagner, who's working on a chemical assay. Then there's a group in France that are working on different assays that can be used, kind of like the freeze-killed brood assay for more general hygienic behavior that would then help everybody be able to assess this trait and really increase it. And then that can lead to, these genes being more widespread. And we're also have other projects with other collaborators looking more specifically at these genes with the idea of being able to do marker-assisted selection down the road. So these are all things that we're actively working on, and we wish that we could give you these tools right now, but they take a long time to develop.
It kind of leads to the ultimate question that I'm sure our listeners are having is how soon can I order one from my local queen breeder and get them into my yard? Is that something that's going to happen, or is this a exercise and intellectual exercise?
Yeah, no, for sure. The USDA and our lab has had different partners over the years working, to try and work with getting the VSHBs out, and that's mostly been focused on getting breeders out and those partners making breeders that they can then sell. Again, we worry about that trait diluting over time or even in one generation, right? So, and right now there's the agreement that we have kind of for these pawline bees, or a paw-like bee, is with the Hilo bees out of Hawaii. And that's that's the only agreement we have right now. So it's the Hilo stock is as close to the paw line as any others. But there are other bee breeders, people that sell bee queens, honeybee queens, that are producing bees that are at least somewhat VSH or have resistance to varroa via VSH or other mechanisms. And I think the important thing is, if people are advertising varroa resistance in their bees or in those queens, is to actually talk to them and say, okay, how are you selecting for it? And do they, if they have sort of the data to back up that their bees are resistant to varroa, then that's who you want to go with, right? Mm-hmm. Just like any other thing that you buy, you want to know if the product that you're buying, if it's, made in a certain way or whatever. And the same thing should be true for queens. I think that we can be responsible sort of consumers and producers, right, for getting the products that we want.
Yeah, evaluating these colonies for varroa resistance is quite labor intensive. You have to inspect brood cells in each colony and then check for mite reproduction and things like that. So it's very involved just to evaluate each colony, and to do this at the commercial scale, it does take a significant investment of time. But like Mike was saying, is that just knowing those criteria that beekeepers, the producers are using, would be really important. So like I said, selection, what criteria, and things like that are critically important to making it viable. Because the trick with any honeybee stock in general is to make sure it lives up to its claims, right?
Yeah.
Is to, if you say your bees make tons of honey, well, let's hope, make sure they make tons of honey. And with VSH, it's no different, is that we want to, if you're going to be selling them, let's make sure that they are producing bees with very low varroa populations.
Well, here's a quick question. If I was a queen producer, selling queens to beekeepers anywhere and everywhere, both breeder stock and general working stock queens, And I wanted to convince people that I was doing things right and that the bees, that they, the queens that they were going to be buying met certain standards. Is there some way, could you put together something, or could a queen breeder put together essentially a cheat sheet that said, okay, virus load this much, varroa load this much, overwintering this percent, you know, list the things that beekeepers are interested in, and rate your bees to, you know, compare your bees to how those things the beekeepers are looking for. Do, am I making any sense here? I mean, you just said it right. I want to know what you're producing. And if I'm buying a car, I want to know it gets this many miles per gallon and, you know, all of these things, or this many miles per charge. I guess maybe that's the new one. But is there some way to do that?
Yeah, I don't know. It's, you know, ultimately it is tricky, right? And so it does, if you're going to say that you're measuring honey production, for example, right? You would have to have some sort of standardized measure. Is it over a season? Is it in Louisiana where they're going to make a ton of honey, you know, in May and June? You know, and or is it 2 week weight gain, right? I don't think we have great standards in terms of some of those measures that then could be widespread across the board and not often environmentally dependent, right? But I think in terms of sort of mite resistance, one of the things would be, is your breeding population, are they, you know, treated for mites? Like, is that part of your selection? If you're treating for mites in that population, then it's hard to assess, you know, mite population growth potentially, right? So like, are you looking at how the mites grow in those breeder colonies over a 3 month time period? That's a really good example of kind of an easier metric that could be done, as long as colonies are, you know, kind of a similar size and make sure they're, you know, queen right. But if you're looking at that mite population growth over time, so your sugar shakes or alcohol washes every month, or and then is that number increasing, that can be one metric. Now, if you have low mite population growth, especially, you know, from that spring season and summer, you know, especially over winter, right? Does that mean you're selecting for varroa sensitive hygiene? No, it means you're selecting for low mite population growth from some mechanism, right? You don't know what that is. So I think it's more of like, if a breeder is saying that they are producing varroa sensitive hygienic bees, how are they measuring it to know that that's what it is? Mm-hmm. If they're selecting just mite resistant, you know, bees, what is that metric? So I don't think it necessarily has to be the same. And I don't think we need all necessarily, you know, VSH bees. I think we need bees that have a variety of traits that they use to defend themselves against all of their various parasites and pathogens. And I think that's what makes a healthy bee population.
Yeah, as Mike was mentioning, there are many different ways to get low varroa population. So the mite reproduction is one way that they can keep varroa populations low. Then another scientist at the lab found that there's this programmed death in the larvae in this one stock that also prevents mites from reproducing. It's called social apoptosis. It's kind of what, it's a behavior that's seen in the original host of the varroa, the Apis serrana, but this was one of the first demonstrations that yes, an Apis mellifera, they could also undergo this sort of programmed social apoptosis where they self-sacrifice the larvae to prevent the varroa from reproducing. So a lot of different ways to get at it. And so it's either, so that under the low varroa population umbrella, there's many different ways to get to that endpoint.
Well, I'm throwing the gauntlet down to the queen production industry to develop a set of standards that I can essentially put an ad in a magazine and say, these are my bees. I bet it can be done. I bet somebody somewhere can figure this out.
And the other interesting thing is that some people have different definitions of what's acceptable to them. So our one beekeeper, they say that my definition of resistance is that I don't have to do two treatments for Midas Head applications. So to them, it's more of a functional sort of operational level of resistance where if he doesn't treat for Varroa in the fall, he still gets good survivorship. So that's, he doesn't know how exactly that happens, that why he doesn't need it, whether it's VSH or the social apoptosis or what the mechanism is. To him, functionally, that's his definition of resistance.
It's the end result that counts.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, what have we missed? You guys have done good work here. I'm excited about being able to go down and get some mite-resistant queens week after next when I have to requeen. What have we missed other than what we've talked about this level of research?
For me, I think that this is really just demonstrating that the importance of Varroa in honeybee colony health. We clearly demonstrated in our study that these bees with VSH behavior that specifically remove Varroa, that's the major difference between this and the commercial stock. All other things being equal, same landscapes, same migratory pathway, same management style, same potential pesticide exposure. So all that stuff is the same, but the major difference here is Varroa. So I think that's what's really important. I think it also really underscores the need for diversifying our Varroa management options. So we have VSH in Pauline. That's really good. Miticides, when you don't have resistant Varroa, tend to work quite well. But there's also things like cultural controls, like we mentioned, the overwintering and then the management programs when, the strategic splitting kind of things and all these other ways. I think we need to think about Varroa management as a system as opposed to, we're just going to use one thing. We're going to use miticides. We're going to use this one thing. Because once you only rely on one thing, nature has a way of overcoming those barriers. And they, like in the case of Ametraz, they develop resistance. So I think building redundancy in the system makes a more robust Varroa management system.
I think you said something that lots of times comes true. Mother Nature bats last. And I think that's true. However, you're beginning to show that there's a lot of ways to, if not control that, at least make it manageable. And I like your term management system for Varroa control management system. That's a good way to end this.
Michael, do you have any closing thoughts?
No, I mean, I totally agree that oftentimes there's a lot of talk of integrated pest management and learning how IPM works for honeybees. And oftentimes that just means rotating chemicals, right? And we often lose sight of the bee. And we really should be promoting all of these great bee defenses that they have against their own, their parasites. The bees can do it if we let them and if we work with them to it. So we have to remember the bees there and at the heart of it all.
Oh, that's excellent thought for closing. Gentlemen, thank you very much. This has been enlightening, and I look forward to being able to find some pole bees somewhere this summer. I'm kidding. Somewhere soon. How's that? So stay warm down in Baton Rouge, and I hope we can talk again.
Thanks. It was great.
Thanks, Gabe.
Yeah, thanks for having us. This is great.
Thank you. Enjoyed talking with you and look forward to having you back.
All right. Cheers.
Absolutely.
Well, that about wraps it up for this episode. Before we go, I want to encourage our listeners to rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download and stream the show. Your vote helps other beekeepers find us quicker. Even better, write a review and let other beekeepers looking for a new podcast know what you like. You can get there directly from our website by clicking on reviews along the top of any web page. As always, we thank Bee Culture, the magazine for American beekeeping, for their continued support of Beekeeping Today podcast. We want to thank our regular episode sponsor, Global Patties. Check them out at globalpatties.com. Thanks to Strong Microbials for their support of this podcast. Check out their probiotic line at strongmicrobials.com. We want to thank BetterBee for their longtime support. Check out all their great beekeeping supplies at betterbee.com. Thanks to Northern Bee Books for their support of Bee Books Old New with Kim Flottam. Check out all of their books at northernbeebooks.co.uk. And finally, and most importantly, we want to thank you, the Beekeeping Today podcast listener, for joining us on the show. Feel free to leave us comments and questions at leave a comment section under each episode on the website. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks a lot, everybody.